given year is actually in, you know, just bread and butter M&A deals.
I was hoping you said you did M&A work, because that's what we're talking about tonight.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I'm glad you do that.
Hi, welcome to the Fieldwork Podcast, a show where continuing legal education is delivered through conversations about law and business. This episode, our host, Gavin, will be interviewing Stephen McKay on the ins and outs of business acquisition after you have executed an LOI. Stephen is a business and finance attorney and a shareholder at Carr Tuttle. So from the attic in Tangletown, this is the Fieldwork.
All right, tonight I'm joined by Stephen McKay. Steve, thanks for joining me.
Not a problem.
So first off, I wanted to let listeners know we have another episode where we focus on considerations during due diligence. Tonight, we'll be focusing on considerations while drafting the deal documents in business acquisitions. I'd encourage everyone to check out our episode on due diligence to learn all about the process before drafting the deal documents. Also wanted to point out, I'm giving a lot of pre-show disclaimers, but it's important to note that we'll likely jump around in terms of buyer side, seller side. We'll try and keep listeners informed on which side we're talking about, and hopefully it's easy enough for them to follow. I wanted to start off this episode by digging into kind of your background, how you got to where you're at. You're currently an attorney at Carr Tuttle. I think there's a little bit of a road that got you there. So
sure.
Let's start off by kind of diving into that.
Yeah, so I started practicing. I graduated from law school kind of at the tail end of the recession. Was actually at UT and had the fortune of being kind of one of the only students out of my class who was interviewing in Seattle. So I think that set me apart a little bit. And fortuitously, I landed a summer internship at Carr Tuttle, and then began there full-time in 2009.
Are you from Texas?
Originally, I'm from Plano, but my parents moved up here before college, so I went to UW for undergrad. That's how I know your partner, Kyle.
Yep.
And then went back to law school, went back to Texas for law school. And so had no ability to convince my then girlfriend and now wife to move to Austin. So kind of yo-yoed and ended up right back.
You picked
up here.
The best city in Texas to convince her, and you still couldn't.
Yeah, so she's Dutch by heritage, and the heat just killed her.
Yep.
The first time we were down there, she was helping me move in. It was August. It was 105 every day. I didn't have a car, and we were walking to a restaurant, and she pointed down and said, "Those cacti are wilting. I'm never going to live here."
Yeah.
And so that was kind of the end of that.
That was the end of that.
Yeah. And so I kind of knew all along that I was going to be back up here. Started in 2009 full time, was lucky to be able to get a job out of law school because a lot of my classmates were getting deferred, and those deferrals kind of became indefinite, and then they had to figure out, okay, well, what am I going to do? And that meant that I started out doing a fair amount of, sort of transactional work, but in, receiverships and bankruptcy, kind of dealing with distressed assets. There was just a ton of that work at that time. And so really got to kind of get my feet wet in the transactional space dealing with those kinds of transactions,
off practice on the depressing side of things.
Kind of. Yeah. But I mean, one of the nice things about bankruptcy and receivership is it's an efficient way of sort of recycling assets that have sort of failed businesses back into the system. And so you really do have to be kind of efficient. You kind of have to jump in and be able to move fast. And so it was definitely a good way to start. And the other thing that I was doing a fair amount then was we had some high net worth individuals who were kind of acting as angel investors, and I was doing a fair amount of corporate finance, helping them with their investments into businesses, so learning about that as well. And really from that, we have a fairly substantial sort of M&A practice group at Carr Tuttle, and sort of just kind of worked my way into that and really got deep into doing M&A work. Worked on that for a few years. We had one sort of micro cap public company, got a little taste of public company work, really liked that, and moved to another firm kind of helping them with public company work with the idea that we'd be building out a practice there. And just through happenstance, we ended up selling almost all of their public company clients. The IPO we were working on pretty much days before we were ready to file publicly, Their biggest competitor called up and said, hey, we want to acquire you. Our client kind of said, well, this isn't really a good time. We've got some other things going on. I said, no, we're serious. Tell us what, you know, you'd like to be acquired for. At that point, the board had to kind of consider their fiduciary duties and ended up turning that into an acquisition. And so at the end of the day, I was pretty much back doing M&A work, had sort of gotten my taste of public company work, realized that it wasn't exactly what I had been thinking, and had kept in touch with the folks at CarTuttle sort of the whole time I was out, and moved back after about 13 months. So I've been back there for over 5 years now.
Okay, and doing primarily M&A work?
Yeah, I'd say probably 2/3 to 3/4 of my practice in any given year is actually in, you know, just bread and butter M&A deals.
I was hoping you said you did M&A work because that's what we're talking about tonight.
Yeah, it's crazy that worked out.
I'm glad you do that. Let's dig into, I'll kind of set the scene. So like I said, we have another episode where we dig into due diligence in an acquisition. I look at the next phase after due diligence as diving into drafting the deal document. So tonight, again, we're talking about the considerations in that. What's generally the first step you get through due diligence, and what's typically the first step that you're walking through with clients?
I think it kind of depends on the type of transaction and whether the seller in the transaction is represented by an investment banker or business broker of some sort. If you've got an over-the-transom offer and there might have been some limited due diligence up front on the financial standpoint, you might just jump right into deal documents. Whereas if you've got a transaction where the seller is represented by a banker, they're probably going to go through a process where they put together a teaser, which has some limited information about the target. They get a big group of people interested in actually acquiring the target. They do a very limited amount of financial and maybe, you know, even less legal due diligence. Then they ask those that are really interested to submit indications of interest. There's a round where they kind of whittle things down, go through management meetings, and then there's a further round where they start working on LOIs. And so in those transactions, you often end up sort of negotiating a final LOI with a party really before you actually dig into sort of the meaty part of due diligence. And so, you know, you've actually kind of got that LOI right up front. You're negotiating that, and that's really kind of the first deal document of substance that we end up working with on most transactions. And those transactions where there is an investment banker, that diligence process sort of follows on after they've actually executed an LOI, gotten into exclusivity, and now they're usually doing a quality of earnings report. And then depending on sort of the speed with which the buyer and seller want to move, they might dual track financial and legal diligence at the same time. Oftentimes, a buyer wants to be able to kind of do the quality of earnings, get it back, make sure there's no showstoppers, and then move into due diligence that's on the legal front. And so once sort of all of that is out of the way, we usually actually will start working on, you know, the definitive agreements for a transaction, you know, the asset purchase agreement, the stock purchase agreement, some of the other major documents. And again, sort of depending on the type of transaction, most of the time it's going to be the buyer's counsel that's taking a first cut at that definitive document. Sometimes in those hot auctions, as they're referred to, you'll actually have seller's counsel prepare an auction draft. That's usually a pretty seller-friendly document. You know, if you're on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being seller-friendly, it might be a, you know, 1, 2, or 3. And then as part of the LOI process, the buyers have to submit markups or issues lists for those documents.
You mentioned hot auction. Can you go explain what a hot auction is?
Yeah. So that's essentially if you've got a process where an investment banker is involved and they've got a number of different strategic and financial buyers who are interested in acquiring the target, the IOIs have come in, you've maybe got 6 to 12, possibly even more parties that are taking a serious look at buying the business. They all know that that's the case. And so they're all going to put their best foot forward in terms of the LOI that they submit.
Which makes it a hot auction.
Yep. Got it. I mean, the alternative is, you know, you get a couple indications of interest, and then after management meetings, a couple other parties drop down, and now you've got 1 or 2 buyers. You know, you really just kind of want to get on a path to move forward at that point.
Yeah. So I mentioned we were going to jump around between buyer side, seller side. Do you have a preference in terms of what side of the table you're on?
I think I enjoy being on the buyer side a little bit more, just because you're kind of doing three transactions at once most of the time. You know, you've got the deal, you've got equity offerings usually, and you've got debt offerings that you've got to deal with. So there's a little bit more legal work involved on the buy side. The nice thing about being on the sell side most of the time is you actually really kind of get to know the business and the owners, and it's obviously a really important time in their lives. You know, most of these companies that we work with are family-owned businesses where, you know, they've started this company 20 years ago, and now they're ready to pass it on to someone else. And so yeah. It's a really important kind of phase in their life, and it's cool to be there kind of as a trusted advisor and helping them through that. But I definitely like being on the buy side a little bit.
Yeah, more. Yeah. So you mentioned on the buy side, it's kind of you're working on three transactions at once. There's the deal, right. the equity offering, and then debt offering. Can you explain that a little bit? So explain the equity offering and the debt offering.
Yes. So essentially, I mean, the money has to come from somewhere. And so if you're representing a strategic buyer, it might just be cash on the balance sheet. But most of the buy side work that we do is, you know, from independent sponsors or private equity groups. Or some kind of buyer that is getting the money elsewhere. And so they'll be raising equity sources. They'll be going to a bank and getting debt sources. And you know, it might not be a bank. It could be some kind of mezzanine lender or party that's going to do a unitranche piece, which means that they're going to take down equity, do some mezz debt, and do some senior debt. But in any event, you sort of have, as I said, three transactions. You know, there's an equity offering. Now that means you've got a group of investors who are going to come in, learn a little bit about the company. They typically know the management team or sponsor that's putting the deal together, got an existing relationship, and they're going to, you know, fund a portion of the purchase price for this target. These deals are almost always leveraged with debt. Sometimes there's some seller paper in addition to traditional bank debt or, you know, as I said, kind of mezz lenders, which are sort of non-regulated banks. And so, you know, for the debt docs, there's, you know, loan agreements, promissory notes, pledge agreements, security agreements, all that stuff that you would expect. On the equity side of things, we're typically doing things in LLCs as partnerships. So we've got an operating agreement, subscription agreements, sort of securities compliance, Reg D's, all that good stuff.
Yep. No shortage of work, especially on the buyer side. Yep. So I know these transactions generally are structured as a stock sale or asset sale, or some hybrid of the two. Can you give a brief rundown of the difference and the characteristics of the two types?
Sure.
You know, what buyers prefer, what sellers prefer, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, fundamentally the difference between a stock sale and an asset sale is that in a stock sale, you are acquiring the ownership of an existing business, and that existing business is continuing on. And from its viewpoint, really nothing has changed but the people who own it. In an asset sale, the buyer forms its own new legal entity, and that entity buys the operating assets from the existing company. And so the counterparties in an asset deal are, you know, one existing operating business and a newly formed, usually shell business that's specially been formed to buy the assets. And in a stock sale, it's typically, you know, the shareholders, if it's a corporation, or members, if it's an LLC, selling directly their equity interests in the business to some other party. You know, most of these transactions, it's not kind of person to person, it's sort of person to some entity that the buyer has set up for purposes of holding that stock. But, you know, that's really the difference. And so in one, you know, the same entity just continues on and it's got new owners. And another, there's sort of a handoff of assets from one entity to another. And so typically I would say that, you know, sellers would prefer that they do a stock sale, and buyers would prefer that they do an asset sale. And of course, all of this ends up being very kind of fact specific.
Sure.
But as a general rule, you know, sellers want a stock sale because they're most of the sort of tax treatment is going to be subject to long-term capital gains, and they're getting a better tax rate. And buyers, generally speaking, want to do an asset sale because they'll get a step up in basis on the assets that are transferred, because most of these assets have essentially been, you know, depreciated down to nothing by the seller. And now you're paying, you know, an arm's length third party negotiated price form, and you're typically able to sort of allocate some stuff and do the whole depreciation dance over again. And so as a buyer, you want to be able to take advantage of that. And then, you know, there's all sorts of different hybrid types of deals that sort of try to bridge the gap between those things. You know, you can do 338H10 elections. You know, mergers have their own sort of tax treatment.
I'm going to assume just with those numbers and letters that's some tax code reference, right?
It is. Yeah. Essentially, it allows you to sort of get asset treatment in a stock sale.
Gotcha.
Under the right circumstances.
Hey everyone, this is Gavin.
And Kyle.
From the Fieldwork Podcast. Keep listening and we'll share the code you'll need to get your CLE credits.
And if you like what you hear, please leave us a review on your preferred podcast platform.
Yeah, and you pay boatloads of money to tax experts in those type of deals, I assume.
A totally reasonable amount of money, yes.
Yeah. So one thing that in talking about tax law, it brings up this concept that's interesting to me. I think in acquisitions and in kind of an M&A practice, air quotes M&A practice, there's not really M&A laws, right? There's not a specific rules that are governing mergers and acquisitions that call themselves M&A law. There's an intersection of a bunch of different areas of law, a bunch of different government agencies that regulate all these things, which has to be part of what makes these deals fun, right? It's complicated. There's tax laws on one side, there's securities laws on the other. There's these general contract principles that I'm sure you're, you know, referring to every once in a while. Is there one practice area or set of rules that you find are the ones you're referring to the most in these type of deals?
I mean, aside from just general contract principles, which sort of come into play oftentimes during negotiations, I think sort of knowing the ins and outs of tax is one of the biggest value adds for transactional attorneys. And that's definitely one area where I'm really kind of constantly trying to up my game, so to speak. And I'm really fortunate to work with some people at Carr Tuttle who are just, you know, gurus in the area and can quote Ginsburg, you know, just from memory.
Right.
And so, you know, working with them has been really, you know, honestly a big part of the reason why I moved back there. And so, you know, that's actually one thing that I think is a big value add of going to an attorney early when you're considering a transaction, either as a buyer considering how to structure the acquisition or as a seller trying to kind of position yourself for sale. You know, some of the structuring that we can help do right up front makes a huge difference. You know, if you position something right up front and say, hey, you know, in this deal, we could do an S-corp inversion and allow a buyer that otherwise doesn't think that they're going to be able to amortize goodwill the ability to do so. You know, and now as a seller, you've put potentially a lot of money back into the buyer's pocket, and you would hope that they're going to sort of reimburse you by upping the purchase price for that.
Yeah. So one other thing I was curious about, you mentioned investment bankers, brokers. Are there referral relationships you have or you've developed over the years that are outside of other practicing attorneys that
yeah,
you'd say are, you know, super important to these type of deals and ones that you'd say you lean on pretty heavily?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that kind of the two biggest other professional sources of referrals for us as M&A attorneys are one, investment bankers, and two, accountants. The investment bankers, obviously, always, you know, their business is buying and selling companies. And oftentimes companies will go and engage an investment banker and they will have, you know, general outside counsel that they've worked with for a long time, who, you know, maybe doesn't have the interest in doing the sale, or doesn't necessarily have the skill set in doing the sale. So there's very often referrals coming from investment bankers. And then accountants oftentimes end up being kind of the first people who know that a business is going to go on the market. You know, they'll get approached when they're doing the taxes maybe, and they'll say, hey, you know, we're thinking about selling next year. How does that affect our taxes or some such thing? And so those two sort of professional groups have definitely, at least from my viewpoint, been really critical relationships to foster because they do just do a great job of referring clients.
Awesome. So for the listeners that are taking notes, that is one, investment bankers, and two, accountants. Those of you building acquisition practices out there, take down those notes and go and start networking with those type of people because it sounds like there's some opportunities to be had in terms of referrals. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the more heavily negotiated terms in deal documents, or sure. some of the more heavily negotiated areas during the process of drafting the deal documents. So at this point, buyer and seller have largely agreed to the material terms of the transaction, and you're now diving into drafting the documents. First off, I guess before we dive into the heavily negotiated areas, beyond just the purchase agreement in these type of deals, what are some of the other ancillary documents that are typical in these business sure. acquisitions?
Yeah, a bunch of them are going to be a function of sort of how the purchase price is structured. And so, you know, in a transaction where you've got some seller finance, maybe you've got an earnout, maybe you've got some money put into escrow, that's going to necessitate having a couple extra documents. You know, at the very least, you're going to have a promissory note that the seller is going to be paid out on. You could have a separate earnout agreement. You'll certainly have an escrow agreement with an escrow agent if you're putting money into a third-party escrow account. And so a lot of those ancillary documents that are sort of beyond the sort of legal boilerplate documents like a bill of sale and an assignment and assumption agreement end up being a function of how the sort of consideration going to the seller is structured. Most often we see that there's some form of seller paper. Most often we see that if there's bank debt, it's going to be subordinated to that bank debt. So you'll have sort of a subordination agreement that is negotiated between your senior lender and the seller. And then again, we already talked about the equity offering and the debt documents. And so there's a whole myriad group of documents sort of for those pieces of the transaction.
Yeah, sure. So depending on what side of the table you're sitting on, you may be right. drafting another two or three sets of documents for the deal.
Yep.
What are some of the, I mentioned before, these heavily negotiated terms. What are some of the terms that you see most often are the ones that you're spending a bunch of the time on in these deal documents?
Yeah, so I think by and large, you know, most transactional attorneys will think of these definitive agreements sort of like insurance contracts. And the reps and warranties are kind of your coverage items. And then the indemnification provisions are sort of how you get paid if there's a claim. And so, these definitive agreements are oftentimes more than 60 pages long. There's maybe two pages that say kind of who gets paid when and how. And then the rest of it ends up being, you know, some conditions and then a ton of reps and warranties. And then a lot sort of on how you get paid if there's a claim under those reps and warranties. And so naturally, the reps and warranties themselves are heavily negotiated. And then all of the various indemnification provisions end up being really heavily negotiated. And so on reps and warranties, as a seller, you know, you want some vagueness in there. You want some qualifications. And so oftentimes...
Some wiggle room.
Yeah, some wiggle room, exactly. And so you'll be adding in what we refer to as materiality qualifiers. You'll be adding in knowledge qualifiers. And people are often sort of arguing over how do you define knowledge? Is it an actual knowledge standard? Is it a imputed knowledge standard? And people want to talk about that.
And so I'm going to stop you right there real quick. So with materiality, you're saying there is a negotiation over how we define material, right?
Sometimes, yeah. So it's kind of two things. Like if you've got a rep that says the seller has complied with all laws, that's an unqualified rep.
Sure.
You know, as a seller's counsel, you might want to say the seller has complied in all material respects with all laws. And now you've got a materiality qualifier in there. And so you sprinkle those sort of throughout the document.
And Matt from the seller side gives you that wiggle room to argue that.
Yeah, exactly. And as a buyer, you want to say, you know, hey, it's not appropriate to qualify that. Or you want to, in your indemnification provisions, strip out those materiality qualifiers. And that's sort of referred to as a materiality scrape. And you can have sort of a single materiality scrape or a sort of double materiality scrape. That those are just kind of some of the terms of the trade, but
so you mentioned materiality and then you mentioned knowledge qualifiers. Tell me a little bit about knowledge qualifiers.
Yeah, so a knowledge qualifier might say we don't have any sort of basis for any sexual harassment claims, for instance. And now, as a seller, you might say, to our knowledge, there's no basis for any sexual harassment claims. And right. now you're kind of covered off if it turns out that some low-level manager in your company has been harassing an employee. You didn't know about it. And if it's an imputed knowledge standard, a reasonable investigation wouldn't have turned up this fact. And so if it turns out after the fact that employee who'd been harassed comes and sues the buyer, you're off the hook. And so you want sort of to be able to say, we shouldn't have to be on the hook for that because we didn't know about it. Now, a lot of this kind of comes down to a couple different camps. One is sort of your watch, our watch. If it happened pre-closing, you should be liable for it. If it happened post-closing, we'll pick it up. And then there's kind of just who should bear the risk of the unknown. And sort of both of those things are kind of discussions that seller's counsel and buyer's counsel often sort of negotiate over. Is it appropriate here that the unknown risk of that sort of low-level manager harassing an employee should be on the sellers or should it be on the buyer?
So is this a situation where you find yourself in a, where you're sort of compromising? You're saying, hey, we'll give you this, but you give us this materiality qualifier, for example.
Yeah, I think oftentimes in transactions, one of the first things that gets done early on after you've gotten a draft of the definitive agreement is creating an open items list. And you kind of go through and you identify sort of everything that you'd like to see changed and you might propose resolutions. And you know, some of them are really important to the sellers, and you kind of say as a group, okay, these are the ones we're going to focus on. We're not really creating these other issues. They're certainly like to have type things, but if we had to give on them, we'd definitely rather trade, you know, A than B. And then the buyer reads the list and says, oh no, this item B is absolutely essential to us. We're not going to give on that. And so, you know, maybe for the seller, that was the one they were willing to give up on. And you can certainly say, okay, yeah, sure, we'll do that, but we need to get this. And so there's definitely a fair amount of compromise. And I think good transactional attorneys sort of don't lose sight of the fact that at the end of the day, you've been engaged to consummate a deal. And the last thing you should be doing as a transactional attorney is sort of sticking to your guns over some point and kind of getting in the way of the business reality that these parties are trying to do a transaction and blowing a deal up. So you definitely don't want to be doing that.
It's a team sport. How often are you seeing at this stage in the process, how often are deals falling apart, or is that happening at a different stage in the process usually?
I think what often ends up happening is that diligence is sort of ongoing kind of all the way up until you've done a deal, until the ink is dry and you've closed. And so when deals fall apart more often than not after you started negotiating the definitive agreements, it's either because one, something came up in diligence that sort of affects the financial picture and the buyer decides, hey, this business isn't going to operate post-closing the way we thought it would. There's a new cost structure item. You know, we were paying a 5x multiple of EBITDA. Sort of, you know, you impute out that, you know, $100,000 cost now is a $500,000.
And these things could happen during the drafting process.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, I mean, diligence never really officially ends. It's not like a real estate transaction where you've waived your your inspection period. And so, it will happen, or just, you know, something will happen, not necessarily in diligence, but, we had a deal a while ago, I think like 2 or 3 years ago, where, an employee, you know, this was a, contracting company, and an employee got in a serious accident, that involved a lot of damaged property. And the insurance company was saying that they weren't going to cover it. And so that became sort of a very big cost structure item that, you know, this had been structured as a stock deal. And we ended up actually having to turn that into an asset deal because the buyer wanted no part of that. But that had the potential to totally blow the deal up. So that's one thing where just, you know, developments happen during the course of negotiations that affect financials. Another is that performance sort of deviates from what was expected. Typically, you're kind of talking to the buyer about what is your financial picture going to look like, you know, not only for the trailing 12-month average or for the last couple of years, but what are your projections going into the future? And so if you take your eye off the business because you're, you know, basically involved in this second job of selling your business and the numbers dip, buyers oftentimes don't like to see that. And so we've definitely had deals fall apart where the seller understandably just was not focused on the business because they were focused on selling it. And then, you know, their numbers took a big hit and buyers didn't want any part of it. And then the opposite happens sometimes too, where, you know, sellers just vastly and wildly exceed their projections. You know, maybe a massive contract comes in and now they're saying, gosh, I don't want to sell this business at this when, you know, my implied multiples now dropped from, you know, 8 to 4. It doesn't make any sense. And so they'll sometimes want to wait out exclusivity and retest the market. But oftentimes when deals are falling apart at sort of this point in the phase, it's a function of something happening that affects the financial picture of what it's going to be like to operate the business.
Hey everyone, this is Jeff
and Kyle
from the Fieldwork Podcast. This is your reminder that you can get CLE credits just for listening.
And after this episode, go to yourfieldguide.com to receive your CLE credits.
And to convince those in charge that you actually listened, you will need this secret code.
Insurance.
Like, fire insurance?
Sure, or homeowner's insurance.
Or car insurance.
Yep, insurance.
Got it, it's insurance.
So these deals fall apart. Do you have any advice for listeners when these deals are falling apart? Something that you found is helpful in those situations, either advising clients or talking with opposing counsel?
Sure.
Just curious tips on that.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's just out of your control and something has transpired that is just, you know, going to be a deal killer and there's really nothing that can be done about it. Other times you kind of have to recognize that, hey, something's transpired or you know, the financial results have differed. And that effectively means you now have to reopen negotiations about price and kind of recognizing that reality that, look, like the deal's just not going to get done if we don't go back to sort of the drawing board. Yes, we have an LOI and it says the purchase price is this. But a deal's not going to happen at that price now. And how are we going to accomplish getting a deal done if that's what everyone wants to do based on this new reality? And so kind of keeping sight of that is definitely one thing. Oftentimes when it's sort of a development that's adverse to the seller, one thing you can sort of propose doing is, okay, hey, we'll do a line item indemnity. And essentially we'll give you dollar one coverage for if this claim that we now know about actually pops up and bites you post-closing. And maybe we'll put a bunch of money in escrow for that. We had a deal earlier this year, actually, where pretty well into the deal, we found out that the seller had a SALT issue, a state and local tax issue, where they just, for whatever reason, had gotten advice that they didn't have Nexus all over the place and had not been paying state and local taxes. And, you know, this was north of $100 million deal, and they end up having to put almost $8 million into escrow to cover that because the buyer said, hey, you know, we're not going to just pick up that
right.
liability.
Yeah.
You guys are on the hook for it, and we're going to go through a VDA process with every state. We're going to do voluntary disclosures, and we need to put basically the amount of money the accountants are telling us you guys owe in taxes into escrow. And if there's any left over, great, you'll get it back. If there's not, you'll have to come out of pocket to cover it. But that's the only way we're willing to do a deal. And the seller was motivated to sell. And because there was reps and warranties insurance in that deal, they actually didn't really have a lot of money in escrow to begin with. So it wasn't like, you know, they ended up with a 20 or 30% escrow on the deal. So it worked out in that circumstance.
So when these deals are falling apart, how often are you getting creative, going to the drawing table, reworking some things, and then deals back on? Or in most cases, deal falls apart. We look for a new buyer, we look for a new seller.
Yeah, I'd say it's a mixed bag, and it's totally fact intensive, fact sensitive. Maybe half of them, I mean, I'm kind of just pulling that number
sure.
out of the air. But I'd say maybe half of them we get back on track after some kind of repricing, and half of them just go into the waste bin. And so, you know, we've got a company now that we're doing a growth equity financing for that sort of fell into one of those examples I gave last year, where it's a great company, just knocking it out of the park, hired an investment banker, spent a lot of time kind of focusing on taking themselves to market, took their eye off the ball a little bit, and ended up, you know, just numbers tanking. It went from, a projected pro forma $20 million EBITDA company down to about 16. And every buyer they'd been talking to was sort of, you know, 20 was kind of their floor.
Yeah.
And, you know, they just didn't end up getting any LOIs. And so we kind of said, okay, well, let's, you know, pause on this effort, revisit things in about a year. And now they're back in the market and they've got an LOI and they're going forward with the process.
Patience is key, huh?
Yeah. And I mean, I think the thing you have to tell sellers, especially when you're representing them, is, hey, look, this is really going to be effectively equivalent to a second job. And you can't take your eye off job number one, which is running your business during this process. And you know, you hear about deal fatigue all the time.
Sure.
And it is totally a real thing. You know, we just closed a deal on Friday of this last week. And the clients were in my office. It was a rare circumstance where we actually had an in-person closing. There were some Canadians on the other side of the deal, and I think they were a little more formal than we might be down here.
Sure.
And, you know, this and deal... Nice. Yeah, they were very nice, of course. This deal had been kind of going on and really kind of hotly negotiated since January. And so we're talking about the better part of 6 months of negotiating this thing. And in my office, one of the founders, there were three of them, found out that on his employment agreement, sort of the other founders had kind of agreed to a term, not intentionally without telling him, but it just, you know, didn't ever come up. And you know, these are great friends. They've known each other forever. They're really good friends. And he just blew up. And we're like, hey, we're closing this deal.
Yeah.
You know, not the time. But, you know, and so we had to sit him down and say, look, you know, this wasn't a term that the other side was going to give on. There's really nothing conceded here because there wasn't anything to get. And, you know, it's unfortunate that you weren't in the loop. But, you know, you can't lose your temper now.
Yeah.
But these people were just, you know, 6 months for people who are used to running a business of negotiating something is a long time. And they had some serious deal fatigue.
Yeah, it can make you go crazy. And I think that's both on the client side and then also on the attorney side. I mean, you get deal fatigue on the attorney side, right? Like you've been working on a deal for 6 months. You have some other deals that might be a little more interesting and you're kind of losing steam on that. Is there anything you found helpful in those type of situations other than just kind of, you know, keep your eye on the prize, stay focused? But is there anything that's helpful in those situations where you're feeling that deal fatigue?
Yeah, I think it's really helpful as soon as you can and as early as you can in a deal to create a closing checklist and kind of always have your eye on, okay, what do we need to do to kind of get to closing? And so sort of being able to kind of just make progress in situations where, you know, you do have a really complicated deal. It's like, okay, we may not be able to solve for X, which is the big kind of immovable object in this deal.
Yep.
But hey, we're gonna tick, you know, Y, Z, and these other things off the checklist. And so, you know, always keep your eye on that big problem, but keep making forward progress, because I think as long as you're making forward progress, oftentimes, you know, that big problem will, or a resolution one way or another will come.
Yeah. So you mentioned closing checklist, making progress. So assuming progress was made and you've now gotten to the stage where everyone's ready to sign, people are ready to wire funds. What does a typical closing look like?
Yeah, so I think, you know, these days, I would say 80%+ of deals are structured as simultaneous signing and closings, which means that, you know, you actually never sign that definitive agreement or any of the ancillary documents until the day you close. So there's no sort of interim period between signing the purchase agreement, where you're sort of obligated, subject to some conditions, to go through with the deal, and then closing. And so really, that 20% of deals that we have that in, there's usually some third-party reason. Like maybe there's an HSR filing because it's a big enough deal to have an antitrust automatic review, or there's some major customer consent where the seller's not willing to go out and ask that customer for consent until they've got a deal in ink that obligates the buyer to buy them. So most deals, your sort of closing is really kind of at the same time you're signing documents. And it's actually almost universally anticlimactic. You know,
sure.
You've done all this work, you've spent all this time and treasure on a deal, and then you get on a phone call at, you know, 9 a.m. in the morning, and it ends 5-10 minutes later, and you got on the call, and seller's counsel released their signature pages, and buyer's counsel released their signature pages. Everyone said they're going to close, and the buyer, you know, main person on the call got instructed to release wires. And it, you know, lasts 5 minutes, maybe less. And so, you know, there's all this frenetic activity kind of right up to that point. And usually, you know, hopefully the morning of closing is not an exciting or frenetic time period. You've kind of gotten all your ducks in a row and you can just get on that call and close. Sometimes that's not the case.
Yeah.
I had a transaction that closed in May that we found out sort of the at about 10:30 the night before we were scheduled to close that... the target, we were representing the buyer in this deal, the target had a unfunded pension liability. And we'd been told, sworn up and down, all up to closing, that there was no unfunded pension liability. The seller's president was on the board of the union, the pension trustee group that was sort of covering it, had letters from the year prior, and it ended up being a big kind of nothing. there was basically a nominal unfunded liability that was less than $50,000, which means that it's actually not a liability. But the union sort of the night of delivered this notice that made everyone think that there was an unfunded liability. And so that closing call did not go smoothly in the morning.
So all they did to the deal was make it where you lost some sleep?
A lot of people lost some sleep. But yes, I definitely lost some sleep. Yeah. But yeah, you're usually kind of before closing, you've exchanged signature pages with the other side's counsel. Everyone's kind of ticking the box that every single document on the closing checklist that needs a signature has one. You've got them all prepared. You've exchanged execution copies. You're going to marry those signature pages up post-closing and create a book. Everything's been negotiated. There aren't any open issues. None of the conditions to closing have are outstanding, or if they are, they've been waived. And so it is kind of checklist based, but yeah, you kind of go through all that process. And like I said, it's pretty sort of hectic up to the point at which you're ready to close. And then, yeah, you get on the phone and release signature pages and initiate wires.
And it's anticlimactic till you start popping the bottles of champagne, right? I'm curious in situations where you run into conflicts of interest. So
yeah,
you've represented a seller for quite a while. A buyer comes to the table that may be another company that you've represented in the past. How often are you seeing that? And then what are some tips for listeners in terms of dealing with those situations when, sure, when you have those conflicts in these situations?
Yeah. So, I mean, as you mentioned, Seattle is a relatively small legal community. And that definitely happens. I mean, we represent some independent sponsors and some sort of quasi private equity groups that, you know, are continually buying businesses. And so invariably we'll either have some, you know, company that we've worked with for a long time that is, you know, on the market, and they'll show up with an LOI in hand and say, hey, you know, this group is going to be buying us. And we say, well, that's interesting. You know, we're their counsel. Or alternatively, one of those parties will come to us and say, hey, we just submitted an LOI on this company. We say, hey, well, that's great. We're their counsel. And so, you know, oftentimes what ends up happening in those scenarios is it's sort of an unwaivable conflict. You've got two current clients. You can't represent them both competently. And so you sort of have to withdraw. And so in that circumstance, having good sources of sort of referrals to be able to pass along those clients to is really key. And again, you know, I mentioned before, a good transactional attorney should kind of keep their eye on the prize of, you know, getting a deal done if it's in the client's interest. And so being able to refer out those deals to people that you know will take care of the client's really important. Sometimes though, you know, you'll have a situation where one of the clients will say, hey, you know, we know you're really good attorneys. We want you involved in this deal somehow, either as our counsel or as the other side's counsel. And as long as the other side is sort of on board with it, if you're going to represent, you know, say the buyer in this instance, you know, they're okay saying, hey, you know, you can stop representing us. We'll become a former client. We will sign a conflict waiver. We sort of understand that you don't have any privileged information from, you know, former representation, right, of us. You know, you check all these boxes that are required under the RPCs to make sure that the conflict is in fact waivable. That definitely happens every now and then. I mean, I think some clients recognize that having experienced sort of competent deal counsel in the transaction increases the likelihood of success. And at the end of the day, they want the transaction to be successful. And so it's definitely actually happened, you know, a handful of times over the 10 years I've been practicing where, you know, we will have had some involvement with both sides. And oftentimes it's the seller that says, it's okay, you guys represent the buyer. You know, we just want you involved in the deal.
Right. Yeah. When you run into those situations, do you guys, and this is just me being unfamiliar with Cartuttle, is this a situation where you guys have your own sort of ethics committee that you guys are having a conversation with in situations, or, cause I know, you know, the Bar Association has their own like ethics committee hotline you can call with situations. Is that something you guys actually tap into?
I don't know. That answer is sort of above my pay grade, probably. You know, sure. We usually take these things to the firm president and kind of say, hey, Bruce, he's the firm president. And, you know, here's the situation. What do you think? And he's kind of, sort of our
chief. I wish I had someone named Bruce that I could take questions like that
chief
too.
Ethics officer, and kind of is involved with our malpractice insurer and sort of on top of these things. And I think it's not exactly sort of just a, you know, tick the box operation, but as long as you can, you know, hold your head high and say that, hey, this is a waivable conflict and both parties want you involved in the transaction, then you can kind of be involved in the transaction. But it does have to be that kind of situation. If it's not, you don't have any choice but to withdraw and make a referral.
Right. Yeah. I'm curious if there's any parts, kind of staying in the same lane on ethical considerations here. Is there any parts during the acquisition process that you see often that are easy to trip up on?
I think actually one thing that's really easy to trip on, as a transactional attorney, is you have to keep in mind that the same sort of, opposing client rules apply as in litigation, where, you know, litigators know like the back of their hand that, hey, we can't communicate directly with the other side's client. Sometimes there's just such a sort of congenial, for lack of a better word, and sort of non-adversarial environment that attorneys will kind of, you know, step out of line and say, you know, like, your out of office will be on, and they'll just, you know, forward an email directly to your client and say, hey, you know, I see Steven's out. Can you respond to this? And you know, that's not a permissible communication.
Right. Right.
And so that definitely happens a fair amount. And so, you know, you've always got to remember that, you know, this other party is represented by counsel, and because they're represented by counsel, you can't communicate with them directly. And, you know, we had this transaction I was talking about earlier that closed on Friday. You know, those Canadians were in our office, and part of the day their counsel wasn't with them, and they kept coming into sort of our conference room and asking questions about the deal. And I was like, guys, I got to step out if you want to talk about this.
Right.
You know, I can't be in a conversation with you. And they're like, oh, yeah, we know, but it's okay. Let's just ask. And I'm like, no, I've got to step out.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you guys step out and have a conversation.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Easy area to trip up on. So one thing we like to end each episode, and we're running out of time here, so I think we're going to wrap things up. But we like to end each episode by exploring some practice management resources. One thing that's interesting to us is just sitting down with people like yourself all over the place, a variety of different experts in different practice areas. We like to know, you know, what are the things in your practice that you found super helpful, resources that listeners would be interested in checking out. I like to ask this question, which is, what's that one thing in your practice that you couldn't do without, if there is something?
Yeah. I mean, that's tough for listeners, at least, because the one thing that I really rely on is just sort of our document server and being able to go back and look at what I did on a prior deal, or look at what one of my partners did on a prior deal, or look at how, you know, maybe another firm that we've got a copy of their purchase agreement from a, you know, transaction where they submitted an auction draft, how they did it. And so obviously, you know, you might have that at your firm. If you're practicing a firm, you know, it's a tough resource to replicate if you're practicing as a solo. But there are other kind of platforms out there that try to sort of replicate that.
Yeah.
You know, like Knowledge Mosaic, which is owned by Nexus, I think, might be Westlaw, one of those two. And then there, I think Bloomberg has a product now that's really good to be able to kind of go in and get examples of documents. But I mean, one thing about being a transactional attorney is you really just do not learn in law school how to be a transactional attorney.
Totally.
At all. It's 100% learning on the job.
Yep.
You know, you learn to think like an attorney and you learn some of the contract principles, but the actual practice, you just have to learn from sort of doing it. And without sort of examples of how other people do it, it's really hard to kind of wade through that. And so definitely having access to prior deal docs is kind of the biggest crutch I've got in my practice.
Yeah, no, that's great. Is there anything you found particularly tough to deal with in your practice? Or and this is, again, we're talking about practice management resources at this point. So if there's anything particularly tough to deal with that you found in your practice, and then maybe advice for overcoming that.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much this sort of fits into practice management, but I think one of the most difficult things to deal with is doing a transaction where opposing counsel maybe takes that term literally, or where they're just not versed in kind of the lingo of being an M&A attorney, and you end up kind of having to be a teacher all through the transaction, and maybe in that scenario kind of swatting down ideas that, you know, maybe on their face don't seem crazy, but in the context of doing a deal are just sort of crazy. like we had a transaction a while ago where the seller's counsel was adamant that if the seller note went into default, their non-compete should go away. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, you think about it, oh yeah, that sounds like a great idea, but it's like, hey, we're buying this business. It's obviously in some distress.
Yep.
We owe you a bunch of money. Why would you want to be able to start competing with us?
Yep.
Like now you're guaranteed not to get that money.
Yep.
But they just would not come off of it. And it was because it was a deal where the attorney just wasn't an M&A attorney. Or, you know, you got someone that wants to fight everything tooth and nail, and they've got a litigation background maybe. And you got to just remind them, hey, this isn't necessarily a zero-sum game. At the end of the day, we're trying to do a deal. And so those things, you know, you got to be unflappable. You got to kind of not let things kind of get to you. And you've got to keep sight of, you know, your client's interest, which is making sure the deal gets done. You know, scoring points by, you know, burning opposing counsel doesn't really work very well.
Yep.
It makes people more entrenched in their positions.
Yep.
And so, you know, you got to kind of swallow your pride sometimes and just kind of keep focusing on compromise and getting to the end goal.
Yeah, and I know it's tough in those situations because I know I found in my practice, you end up feeling in some of those situations like your client is paying you to educate opposing counsel, or your client is paying you to explain to the other side what a particular term is or why this is unreasonable, which is, for me, tough to swallow sometimes. And I know something that it's a delicate balance to not appear like you are slowing down the deal for your client.
Sure.
Or doing something that doesn't make sense for your client. Because a lot of time your client doesn't totally understand why we're going back and forth on this, you know, particular term.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we've had transactions where, you know, we represent buyers, you know, deal in, deal out. And, you know, they get a bill at the end of the deal and they say, hey, this wasn't a complicated deal. What's going on? And you're like, guys, like we had to spend so much time in this,
right?
Like talking to opposing counsel about, you know, why this is market, why this is common, why we're doing this, why we aren't willing to do that. And that definitely burns the resources and it's hard. And you kind of do end up having to, you know, eat some of that at the end of the day because, yeah, your client's like, well, what do you mean? Like, you know, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So kind of left field question for you, or just kind of different question here. Anything you've read recently, watched recently, that you think our listeners would be interested in, could be related to M&A deals, could be completely unrelated, just anything interesting.
Yeah. In the vein of interesting, I just finished the 7th book in the Expanse series.
Okay.
Which is sort of a sci-fi space opera. But I think anyone that's interested in sort of world building, in fiction would really, really like this series. It's great. You know, it's been super entertaining 7 books in, and unlike some authors who will remain unnamed, they've been excellent about publishing a book a year. So there's only 2 years left in the series. And if you don't like reading, sci-fi and now Amazon have been doing the show. And so it's in its 3rd season and it's just really great. I like it a lot because it's sort of, I think the genre would be sort of hard science fiction in that it's essentially kind of imagining what our future would look like once humans have sort of moved out beyond Earth orbit. And so it's, you know, really great writing, really entertaining, and I've just really enjoyed it. I definitely kind of like being able to take some time out of my week and do things that are not work related. I
sure.
think that helps keep me sane.
Yep.
And, you know, reading for pleasure is definitely one of those. And so I can't recommend that series enough. I think the author, it's a pen name for the author. I want to say it's James S.A. Corey,
okay.
But it's 2 guys who write it. And it's really, really good. I mean, you can Google The Expanse and you'll find the books.
Awesome. So will you be starting your own podcast on The Expanse anytime soon?
I don't think so. I mean, I enjoy it. But I don't have enough free time to get into sort of a full on podcast on my own, and I probably wouldn't have enough commentary to keep people entertained.
Sure. Yeah. I think it sounds like your practice is keeping you busy enough. Your toddler's keeping you busy enough.
Yep.
Building your own board games, keeping you busy enough. So that's all we have for tonight. Steve, I want to thank you for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is the Fieldwork Podcast, a show where we deliver continuing legal education through conversations about business and law.